This is the continuation of session one.
Could you say something? Several people have expressed an interest in Buddhist refuge. Mm-hmm. Just say a little bit about that. This is a good time.
It's a great time. I mean, and I will stop at five, so don't worry. If you take the three objects of refuge, which are what? Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Okay, there's a thing. This is a whole thing from the monastic textbooks. If you wanted to study it, it would take about a week. And it's beautiful. It's really beautiful. But basically, there's a difference between the Buddha and the Buddha jewel. And there's a difference between the Dharma and the Dharma jewel. And there's a difference between the Sangha and the Sangha jewel. The jewel is the one you take refuge in. And the jewel has two flavors, two versions. One we call actual and one we call figurative. Okay, so figurative Buddha jewel. You know, the thing you go to refuge to is the jewel and not the thing by itself. So the jewel, the Buddha jewel, the Buddha Ratna, is there's a figurative one and there's a real one, the literal one. Okay, the figurative one in the case of the Buddha Ratna is this image, is an image of the Buddha. That's the figurative Buddha Ratna. We don't go to refuge to the Buddha. I mean, you can come in here and sit down and ask this piece of bronze for protection, and not much will happen, you know. We need pictures of the Buddha, and they're important, and they have a function in taking refuge. You can imagine the Buddha because of this piece of bronze. But obviously the literal Buddha Ratna is what? It's that real being, and it's particularly the Dharmakaya, which is the ultimate reality of the Buddha. It's actually the emptiness of the Buddhist mind. Okay, that's particularly what you're taking refuge in. You seek protection in the Buddha. That's one kind of refuge. The second refuge, you could say, Dharma. What's figurative Dharma refuge, and what's literal Dharma jewel? What's the figurative Dharma jewel? We'll start with Sangha. Sangha's easier. What's the figurative Sangha jewel? What's the one that you can look at and see? And it's monks and nuns. Anybody who's wearing this red cloth, if you're a Tibetan Buddhist, you know, this is the Sangha. It's the Sangha jewel. They represent the refuge of Sangha. But what's the real Sangha? Anyone who's perceived emptiness directly. Perceiving emptiness directly is what really saves you from samsara. You know, it's really nice, it's cool, that the refuge you go to should be a person who has seen emptiness directly. That's the real protection, is a person who can explain it to you. And then what's the Dharma jewel? What's the figurative one? It's the books, it's the papers, it's the teachings, it's the sound of the teachings as someone teaches them. And what's the real Dharma refuge? It is the perception of emptiness. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You know, it's the cessations and the paths in the mind of an Arya Bodhisattva. Okay. So it's the perception. Again, it's the perception of emptiness. That's what can protect you. And then Buddha, with the Buddha Ratna, we're mainly stressing his Dharmakaya, which you perceive during the perception of emptiness directly. The emptiness you perceive is, you do perceive the Buddhas directly also. So really, when you take refuge, you're taking refuge in mainly the perception of, the direct perception of emptiness. By the way, if you saw a Buddha directly during your perception of emptiness, or immediately thereafter, actually during, because you're seeing the emptiness of the Buddha, would you ever doubt them? And if you saw your future lives directly, and if you knew you weren't crazy, if you had this other perception that you were correct, would you ever doubt Buddhism again? No, you just wouldn't. And until that point, you probably should or can or will. But at that moment, you cannot ever doubt it again. You meet the Buddhas directly. You see your future lives and many other things. We'll talk about tomorrow. You could no longer ever have doubt about it. Also, you could never again think that the way you saw things before was correct. Even though you are now forced to see them again that way after you come out of the direct perception of emptiness. Very interesting. So there's only two mental afflictions that are eliminated by seeing emptiness directly. The path of seeing has only out of 84,000, only two mental afflictions that you can never have again. And one is doubt about the path. And one is that you believe the way you see things is correct. You know, those two, that's the only two things you can never have again. So why should it protect you to see emptiness?
It's bound to put you on the path of hopefully only good karma.
Yeah. It's because emptiness and acting good are so intimately related, you could say married, huh? that it protects you. Because having seen emptiness, you will never again want to. You may do out of control, and you do out of control, but you would never knowingly, wantonly do something bad, because it's just it's suicide. You know, you're only hurting yourself, and when you understand emptiness, then you understand that perfectly. So the last thing you'd want to do if someone yelled at you at work would be
to holler back.
To yell back, you know. That's the answer to your question. I think we got there. You know, at that moment, you have a choice. You know, the karma has brought you an ugly, red-faced, yelling boss. I have a couple of them. Especially when the orders are late. And they're in your face, and they're yelling at you. And if you understand their emptiness, which means that you're having this perception because it's being forced upon you by your past deeds, then the last thing you'd want to do is what? Yeah, exactly. Do you want to perpetuate it? What, you like it? You want to do it again? Okay, yell back at him. You know? You want to meet this guy again? Yell back. You know, if that's your only desire in life, if that's your goal, is to meet this face again, yell back at him. Be angry. You know, let your heart start beating faster and get red and say something back. Because if you want to see him again, it's not the best way, it's the only way to see him again. And that's the whole fourth path. That takes you the whole fourth path. So that's refuge. That's real refuge. That's real protection. What else can protect you? During the Buddha's lifetime, his people were wiped out by a neighboring tribe. And they came and ran behind him and hugged him for protection. And they were slaughtered, touching him, holding him. They were slaughtered around him. And, you know, the Buddha can't do anything. From that point of view, there's certain blessings they can give that help you understand things, but if you don't obey the laws of karma, nobody can help you. You know, they're law. That's why they're called laws. They can't be broken even by the Buddha. You know, the only thing that can protect us is understanding and the good behavior that understanding causes you to have. I think that's a good place to stop. So we'll do. You have some prayers that you do.
Sāshī bhūti jūshī metā jāṁ Vīrā vīṁshī nyūndē gyāmpādī Sāṅgē shindhū mithē uvāgī Jogu nāndā shīvā jūpā
This is the end of session 1. Session 2.
Sāshī bhūti jūshī metā jāṁ Vīrā vīṁshī nyūndē gyāmpādī Sāṅgē shindhū mithē uvāgī Jogu nāndā shīvā Sangye chadam sangye chonama Janju Badu Dagni Kapsu Chi Dagi Chimin Dipe Sunangi Dora Penche Sange Jubasho Sange Chodam Sange Chonama Janju Badu Dagni Sushi Dagi Chunyan Dipe Sunangi Jola Penche Sange Jubasho Sange Chudan Sange Chudama Chanchu Badu Dagi Kasuchi Dahi chunyen kibe sunangi Yola penche sange jubasho.
Yesterday we went through karma. We started out from the Abhidhamma Kosha, and there's the famous lines from the opening of the fourth chapter, and it talked about how karma creates planets and all the beings who live in the planets. And then we talked about the essence of karma was Semba. What's Semba?
The
it's just where the mind twitches, where the mind moves the slightest bit. That's Semba. That's the essence of karma. That's Yigile. Semba Yigile, you know. That's the essence of karma. Then because of that karma instigates two other kinds of karma. What are they? Oh boy, no reviewing here.
You want
a Tibetan? No, I don't need Tibetan here. Body and speech, okay. Deeds of body and speech. The drivers up here is Semba. And every time Semba goes like that, then your hand goes like that, and your mouth goes like that, you know. Semba instigates the other two. The essence of karma is Semba, that movement of the mind, the twitching of the mind. And in that much time, it's 64 different discrete movements of the mind can occur in that amount of time. And that's how many karmas, that's the rate at which we are collecting karma. We went through that. And then it was sort of interesting. You have to know how karma is, in the example in the reading was when you leave a flower in a vase and then you take the flower out, or when you have butter on a paper towel and you take the butter off, and the scent of the flowers remains in the vase, and the stain of the butter remains on the paper towel. And when you see yourself, the main thing is when you see yourself doing a good deed or a bad deed, that perception stains the person, okay, if you want to get technical. But it puts a sort of a stain, or it leaves a sort of a trace on the, you can say on the mind, okay, on the stream of the mind. It leaves a trace. And at that moment, just before that moment that the trace is left, the deed stops, the action stops, the thought stops, the words stop, the actions of your body stop. So where does the karma stay? I mean, the deed is finished. The word that you said to somebody, you yelled at somebody and your mouth closed and you were finished saying it, and somehow that deed gets carried on. And then we talked about how the energy is transferred in the form of a what to the mind?
Bhakcha.
Bhakcha. Okay, we don't have any good word for that. I'd say mental seed, maybe. People struggle with that. But it leaves it leaves that trace of a scent, like a flower on a vase, in the mind stream. And that from the first moment on, even though that bhakchak is being destroyed like all changing things, instant by instant, it's in one finger snap that bhakchak has gone through 64 discrete forms and changed 64 times. But the energy is transferred from each one to the next. So it's a long stream of bhakchaks carried in your mind. For how long?
Millions of years.
I mean, millions is sort of... millions is hard. It's kalpas. Kalpa is very hard to measure. The third chapter of the Abhidharma also talks about how long is a kalpa. It's an eon, right? It's very hard to calculate because it's the time in which the world goes through a number of 80 different huge transformations. And I haven't really figured it out yet. I mean, I think Bhutan Rinpoche tried, and it was millions and millions and millions. Okay, a karmic box art can stay long, much longer than that. The energy is being transferred from moment to moment. Then it flowers. The conditions occur, and suddenly this thing flowers. Where does it flower according to the mind-only school? When the karma seed ripens, where does it ripen?
In your
perceptions. It is in your perceptions. They say it's actually like ripening on a screen. It's like a movie being projected onto a screen, and that screen is one of your consciousnesses. It's part of your mind. And according to the mind-only school, that part of your mind called kunshi, you're watching it, and every time you think you see somebody sitting in front of you talking, you're actually just watching your mind as the karmic seeds begin to ripen, and they are ripening, and you see the person's hand move, and his lips move, and his sounds are coming out, and you're actually watching one part of your own consciousness. Does the higher school accept that? I mean, we're supposed to be higher school, Madhyamika Prasangika. What do we say? Is that okay? Was that explanation okay?
Yeah.
We say it's all right. We don't say there has to be a separate consciousness called kunshi, but we say in the own stream of the mind, in your own stream of your mind or your person, these images come up. You take data from the outside, you interpret it in a certain way, and you see things. You know, I see you, you see me, and you see things changing. So they do. You do get data, but you're interpreting it a certain way. And each one of us interprets it differently. Is that a voluntary process? Can you decide how to interpret the data that's presented to you? No, that's the whole point. It's forced on you by your karma. And that's the whole... That's in a nutshell what's going on, you know. We would like to be... I mean, when the dentist is drilling your teeth... I remember when it used to happen to me, and he hit the nerve, and I was... it's a she, actually, and she would hit the nerve, and I'd say, okay, let's meditate on emptiness and see if it helps, you know. And it doesn't help, you know. And I challenge you, you know, give me anyone who says differently, and let me drill on their teeth. And let me see if they jump, you know. And you know, I mean, you can hope or wish that there were people who weren't like that, but your instinct is that, you know, when you stick a needle into most people, they jump. And... Or something hot, they're going to move. It's a reaction. They are conceiving it that way. It's real. Madhyamika is very adamant, you know. Okay, it's only a projection. It's only an interpretation of some data. But it works. I mean, Nagarjuna says... Do you remember Woodstock where Max, what's his name, got up and said, I'm a farmer, you know? You remember. Max Yasgur, right? And anyway, he gets up and says, I'm a farmer, and then everyone starts cheering, you know. And Nagarjuna's famous statement, he says, I'm a farmer, you know. He says, whatever farmers believe, I believe, you know. You take your seeds, you put them in the field, you cover them up, you wait, plants grow. What he's saying is everything works. Even though everything is a projection, everything is absolutely real. And it works. And if you don't think so, then drill your teeth or stick a knife in your arm and see if that projection makes you jump, you know. And it will. Or walk out in front of a projection of a car on the highway, you know, and it'll run you over, you know. So it's not, it is artificial, but it's real. It's artificial in the sense of being a projection. It's real in the sense it's forced on you, and it does hurt. And it will hurt you. And it's not a voluntary thing. If it were, then it'd be easy. We'd all... You know, in the next moment from now, we'd all be living in a tantric paradise, and there'd be no more worries. But it's not like that. You have to create the causes for it. You have to... Creating a paradise, which we're going to talk about later today, is a thing you have to do quite purposefully and consciously, and it takes time. Rome wasn't built in a day. I thought all of that is a summary of yesterday, and there's a very good reading in here. It's in the second section. If you go to... It's in the... This is all very technical books from the monastery, and I don't think you have to necessarily master all of that. I mean, what I said is in there, but what I'd like to do is give you the reading so you can confirm that. And I'm not making it up, or it's not my idea. I like to stick straight to the original books. These are the original texts. So if you go to the second section, there's a second yellow page, and at the top it says Course 5, Reading 6, Karma and Emptiness, and it's page 2. And at the bottom, there's a reading from Gyu Lama, Gyu Lama is, what's it?
Uttara-tantra.
It's called Uttara Tantra. It's not a tantra, okay? It's called Uttara Tantra. It means, it's a book by a sangha which is not secret. Tantra means secret. This is not a tantric book. It's just part of the name. And it has a different meaning. But it was written by, written down by a sangha. Who lived, I guess, around the 3rd century, something like that, 4th century, 350. And he had contact with Maitreya. Who's Maitreya?
Future Buddha.
Future Buddha. Is he a Buddha already or not?
Sure.
There's a big debate in the monastery. If he was, then this book would be in the Kangyur. But it's in the Tengyur, which means it's a commentary, which means the author is not a Buddha. But so there's a big fight about it. Anyway, Maitreya basically dictated this book to a sangha along with 4 other books. Very famous, the 5 books of Maitreya. And this is like a little nutshell presentation. It's a commentary to that text. And I like it because it's very short and it has everything in it. It has the steps to how samsara, or how this circle of suffering begins and how it's maintained. So I think if you just learn those few steps and you remember them, you'll see why you're here. Okay. So I'm going to put them one by one and then we'll come in them. Say Dangzin. Louder, you're sleepy. Dangzingi. Bakchat. Dangzingi. Bakchat. Okay, the trouble starts here, okay? This is the first problem. Dangzingi Bakchak is where the trouble starts. According to
Asanga
is the, what do you call it? He's taking dictation from Maitreya, up in where Maitreya's heaven. And so this is basically Maitreya. So we can buy it because it's spoken by a Buddha. He hasn't come yet, but he's a Buddha. So Dangzingi Bakchak. Dangzin means the habit or the tendency to grasp to self-existence. Okay, it's the habit or the tendency to grasp to things as being self-existent. An example would be looking at a glass of water and thinking that it has to be a glass of water. Okay, I mean, or a more real example for me and maybe for you too is the person at work that you don't like. Okay. If you don't have one, you're very unusual. But it's the person at work, or maybe it's a relative of yours, or something like that, who just irritates you whenever you're around them. They push your buttons. They know how to do it. You look at them, and you grasp them as self-existent. You believe that they are inherently something irritating, and that, therefore, anyone who comes in contact with them must be experiencing them the way you are. Because of course you believe you're right, and you like it the more people who think that, because it proves that you're right, and you even go about trying to impress on people how if they don't think that way they should think that way. But the fact is that probably there's someone in the world, you know, like the person's mother. You hear on TV all the time, they interview the lady whose son just killed 12 people, and they say, you know, is he a bad boy? And she says, no, it's not him. I don't believe it. You know, and someone in the world loves this person, and someone in the world, when they meet this person, has this perception of them as being a very lovable object, and you think the opposite. So that's Dangzin. If you think they are inherently a bad person, you know, that they by themselves must be bad. By the way, if you're right, and if they are self-existent, then every person who came in contact with them would have the same reaction. If being irritating is an inherent quality of that person, then everyone who met them would have the same reaction, because that's an inherent quality of that person. But that's not the case. If the irritatingness, is that, I don't know, if being irritating were an inherent quality of them, then it's not coming from your side. It's not a projection of yours. It's actually coming from them. And since that's the case, then everyone who ever came in contact with them would have the same impression. They would all see them as irritating. That's a self-existent, irritating person at your office. Okay? That's what it would be if it existed. All right? So Dangzin is the tendency to think that way, and we do think that way. We believe that. You won't go to work and tomorrow and change. By the way, is the person irritating? Are you having a pramana? Are you having a correct perception? Or are you crazy?
Crazy.
No, is the person irritating to you?
Yeah.
They are. Yeah. It's a tema, it's a pramana, it's a valid perception. They are. And they really, I mean, except in cases where you're driven by extreme jealousy, which happens, or something else. But if you're just a normal person, and someone comes in, and they talk too loud, or they say stupid things to you, or they're trying to get your job, or they're trying to make you look bad, they exist. And they really are doing that. They truly are doing that. And to you, they are irritating. All the data is there, and you're interpreting it in a way which is correct for you. In that sense, they are really irritating. Truly, they are an irritating person, but not inherently. Because if somebody else is in the office and you know they're watching this go on and they're loving it, you know, oh, Michael's finally getting it, you know, I've been waiting for this for a week, you know, and if he were self-existent, irritating, then they would also feel as bad as you feel, but they don't, because he's not self-existent. So, but our tendency, Bhakshak is what? It's that mental seed. Okay, the trouble starts here. This Bhakshak comes along with every sentient being when they're born. If you're not a Buddha, you have this Bhakshak in your mind when you're born. So insects have it, amoebas have it, humans have it. Everybody has this Dangzinki Bhakshak. This is the mental seed for thinking that way. The mental seed for thinking of things as being self-existent. Or that the guy at the office is self-existently or inherently irritating. And everyone who ever met him should have the same reaction as I do. Because I'm right. Okay, you are right, but not that way. Say, Dangzin.
Dangzin.
Ni.
Ni.
Dangzin.
Dangzin.
Ni. So by the way, if you want to put the English on the number one, it would be something like the seeds for holding things are self-existent. The seeds for holding that things are self-existent. That would be...
Are you going to talk any more about how that changes? I mean, I'm getting a picture like they're all there, but things you do may change all of them as they go on today.
Yeah, we'll talk about it before the end of the day. So now say Dangzin Yi.
Dangzin
Yi. Dangzin means, again, that tendency to grasp things as being inherently existent. The tendency to grasp things as being existing from their own side. And then Yi means two. Number two. And there's two different versions of that tendency. We have both of them. One of them is what we call inherent, and one of them is what we call learned. And the first one is sort of an, what do you call it? When something congenital? I have all these doctors here. One is a congenital Dangzin, and really, and the other is intellectual. Okay, so one is very deeply ingrained in the being of a person, and the other is intellectual. You lose the second one at the path of, can you guess? Seeing. Okay, when you see emptiness directly for the first time, and you come back down out of that, you can never again believe that you were right. Okay, when you thought that the guy was irritating from his own side and that you weren't projecting it, you know you're not right, but you go back into doing it, and you have to do it, and you will do it, because you still have number two. You still have the other Dangzin, which is congenital, and it forces you to see things the wrong way. So it's a weird situation. You're sort of a schizophrenic from the Tonglam on. From the path of seeing on, your life is kind of schizophrenic. You know you're seeing things wrong, and you can't stop yourself. So you don't have the intellectual belief in what's going on, but you can't stop it. The day that you can stop it, you're very close to reaching Buddhahood. It's like Bodhisattva level number 8 or 9. The day that you can stop that, you've reached a very high level. So these are the actual forms of that tendency. So here's how trouble starts. First of all, you have that seed in your mind for thinking things exist from their own side. That guy is irritating. It's not me that's doing it. It's him. It's coming from him. And if anybody had a right mind, they would see it too. They just haven't figured it out yet. You know, but he from his own side is the irritating person. It's, I'm not participating in it. I'm not causing it. He's self-existently irritated. That belief which infects all your awarenesses is Dangzin Yi. That's the two Dangzin. So far we have two steps. One is the seeds of this in your mind. And then the actual tendency itself comes out. And it's not that you're... Ignorance is like this. Ignorance infects every perception you have. But it's not conscious all the time. In other words, you're not thinking to yourself. And rarely do you think to yourself in the heat of the moment of being irritated, oh, this guy is bad from his side. It's not my projection, you know. But that's implied in all your perceptions. You don't say it to yourself, but you believe it. You believe that he is truly, inherently irritating from his side. And if he could get his act together, everything would be all right. Okay, that's what inherent existence does to you. You believe that it's his fault and he should straighten things out and then everything would be all right. That's step number two. Step number three... This is how samsara runs, by the way. This is how samsara gets better. According to Maitreya. So the first two, what was the first of the first two? The mental seed for thinking that way. And then number two is when you actually start thinking that way. This is explaining, by the way, how it comes from your past life. I mean, your past life, you had it. You died. But those seeds were planted in your mind, and then now in this life, it starts to assert itself again at a very early age. Then Tsulmin Yijie, say Tsulmin Yijie. Tsulmin Yijie. This is an abbreviation. Tibetan is cool because if you can't remember the whole phrase, you can just cut out a bunch of syllables. It's Tsushin Mayimba Yila Chepo. And then you can say Tsulmin Yijie. This is very interesting. Tsulmin Yijie means to direct your mind in a mistaken way. Okay, it's a mistaken perception. Okay, mistaken perceptions. Yijie means to direct your mind at something or focus something. Tsulmin means against the rules or against the real way it should be. Your lama who teaches here is Geshe Tsulga. That tsul means the way in the sense of morality. I think, and then he's at Tsultim Lagawa, which means he enjoys morality. Okay. But this tool means to think the wrong way. Okay, to think the wrong way. And the object is very important, so I'm going to stick that in too. Say Yiwon, Yimion, Yiwon, Yimion. Okay. Yiwon is a nice word. Yi means what? Mind. Tibetan has like 20 words for mind. Forget trying to find different words in English, you know. Yi Ong. Ong means to come. And Yi Ong means pleasant or pleasing to the mind. It comes to the mind. Okay. Yi Ong means like a beautiful flower is Yi Ong. Or this, we call kapen, this pillar cover is Yi Ong. It's very pleasing to the eye. It's very nice colors. Pleasant, pretty. And that's called Yiwong. Yi Miong is the opposite. So what's that? Yi Miong means unpleasant to the eye or unpleasant to the ear, which pretty much describes this guy at your office, okay? That's Yi Miong. You know, I give this as an example in Dharma classes, and then we talk about it week after week. And then invariably someone comes up to me after class and says, and starts complaining about this other Dharma student or this guy at the office. And I say, wait a minute, this I've been talking about for 2-3 weeks. I mean, they don't connect it with the whole class we've been having for a month or two, you know. This is the time came, you have to apply it now. You met the guy, you know. And it's somehow we have this blindness. We're very interesting, you know. So Yiwong means pleasing to the eye, and Yimiong means unpleasing to the eye. And the Tsulmin Yijie, this mistaken perception, focuses on nice things and things that aren't nice. That's step number three. This messed up way of thinking, which is triggered by what? What was number two? The tendency to think of things as being self-existent. Which was triggered by the seed which came from your past life. So you come into this life with a seed in your mind for it. It starts to assert itself. And then you focus on nice things, and you hold them to be self-existent. And you focus on those nasty things, like that guy at work, and you start to hold his badness as self-existent, something coming from him. Okay, that's Sushin, that's Suming Yiche. It's focused on nice things and bad things. Okay. What was number one? Say Decha. Decha. And Shedang. Decha. Shedang. Okay. In the wheel of life, which is at the door entryway of your Gomba here, in the outside there, which is required by Buddhist custom since the time of the Buddha, that we should remember what one of his disciples saw when he sent him to hell to check things out. He said, draw it when you get back and we'll put it on the door of every temple. People won't forget what it was like. That's one of the ways in which this painting was made. There's another way also, but at the very center there's three animals. Do you remember what are they? You can, snake, pig, and a rooster. Okay, snake, pig, and a rooster. And those represent what are called the three poisons. Here you have two of them. Duchak is desire. Shedang is hatred. Okay. Desire is the rooster. Oh, yeah. And hatred is the snake. Okay. And they're at the very center of the wheel of life. They run the wheel of life. Okay. You know, what's the last time you had desire or hatred?
Again.
No, I mean, I used to think, you know, desire, that's pretty strong. It's like, you know, I would have to have some really bad desires, like probably have once a day or once a week or something. And shedang, you know, anger or hatred, or there's malice sometimes. I mean, I haven't had shedang. I mean, I haven't hated somebody for a couple of days, you know. So I don't know if those translations are useful. I'll give you the definition. The definitions are in Maitreya's text here, the commentary here. The definition of Duchak is which means you do not want to lose those nice objects, those yuong objects, those pleasant objects. It's the desire not to lose a pleasant object. So I think sometimes it should even be translated as liking something. I mean, if you say, what was the last time you liked something, that was as recent as a few seconds ago. You know, you liked what that person said, or you didn't like what they said, or, I mean, liking and disliking go on moment by moment. It's not like passion or hatred or, you know, and I believe, I mean, if you check it out, these two mental functions are going on constantly. You're constantly liking something or disliking something. So I think those, the pig and the, what was it, the snake and the rooster, those are there all the time. It's not like you have a blow-up of a rooster once a week or something. You know, these are constantly infecting our minds. And I think that's why they're called poisons. They're running like poisons through our blood. We have them every moment of our lives. Duchak, we are struggling not to lose the things which are yuong to us, which are pleasant to us, which strike us in the least pleasing way. Shedang is the opposite. It's which means you are struggling to get free of things you don't like. You're struggling to avoid the objects which are not pleasing to you. The guy at work. It's like you hear he got sick or he was fired and you're like, oh, that's terrible. You know? You know? That's a shedang. So shedang, I don't think it's as strong as anger. It's like this wish that you could get away from this object. And our lives are based on that. Our whole lives are running on that. We are constantly go through the day trying to hook up with things we like and trying to escape from things we don't like. And our whole day is spent doing that. And then a lot of Buddhists get confused because am I not supposed to do that? You know, am I supposed to like something that's dislikable, unlikable? Am I supposed to dislike something which is likable? You know, they get confused. They tell you that's wrong. And then you think, well, maybe I shouldn't eat ice cream or, you know, I mean, you get confused about what it is you're supposed to be doing. And you get sort of schizophrenic also, you know. You're not quite sure how you should be acting. The goal of Buddhist practice is to reach a state of being where every object is yuong. where it's every object is pleasant. But here we're talking about the wrong way to get there. So there's a distinction. Obviously, the way that Buddha paradises are described, they have a lot of the characteristics of the beautiful things in your life now. You know, the relationship you have with people, the beauty in the world, the nice things that happen to you during your life. You can't say those are ugly or bad or stupid or things like that. I mean, Buddha paradises have those things. They don't have the tail of the dog hooked on. You know, they don't have the lousy ending that our pleasures have. And that's just a distinction. It's not that the nature of a pleasant thing is bad. It's not bad. It's obviously it's nice, and obviously you come to Buddhism class because you're hoping to reach some place where everything would be like that and you wouldn't lose it. So there's a distinction between stupid desire and spiritual desire, you know. Here we're talking stupid desire, okay? Why? Because this one came from those causes. So we can go backwards, you know. Sometimes they do the wheel of life in reverse, and sometimes they do it. They call it Lung Dok and Lung Jung. You know, you get good where you can go both ways to explaining the wheel of life. Let's go backwards. This kind of desire or liking and this kind of disliking is triggered by what? What was number three? Number three was what? It was a wrong way of looking at nice things and unpleasant things. It was a wrong way of looking at pleasant things and unpleasant things. Tsushin mayimba yila chepa. It was a wrong way of looking at pleasant things and unpleasant things. It was thinking they were self-existent. So liking things and disliking things in a worldly sense is triggered by misperceiving nice things and bad things. It's triggered by a wrong idea about nice things and bad things. It thinks that those nice things and bad things come from their own side. Okay? If you didn't have that, it wouldn't trigger this. We're seeing how you get in trouble. You know, we're seeing how the downward spiral. So, this kind of liking and this kind of disliking, which are dysfunctional and harmful and going to cause other things, are triggered by not understanding objects. You know, not understanding where this irritating guy from the office came from. Not understanding where this pleasant thing that you would like to have comes from. And where its pleasantness comes from. It's not understanding where it's you have a dysfunctional thing going on. So, liking and disliking in the normal sense are triggered by not understanding nice things and bad things. And that's triggered by what? The not understanding. Triggered by the tendency to see them as self-existent. And that's triggered by the seeds. So cool. You know, you've got four steps here. It's very clear. Maitreya is pretty good, I guess. Say le sak. Le sak. Le sak. We had le yesterday. I don't know if you remember it. Lega. Remember le? It meant work. In Tibetan, it means karma. Okay? It's a Tibetan word for karma. Okay, sak means to collect karma. Okay, accumulate karma, collect karma. In other words, you do a bad deed. How did that come from the last one? What was the last one?
The struggle to avoid.
It's liking and disliking. Ignorantly, okay. You can do it in enlightened way, it's fine. Okay, but ignorantly, you see something you like, you'd never want to be separated from it, and you see something you don't like, and you'd love to be separated from it. Okay, those lead you to lesak. Those lead you to collect karma. Those lead you to do something wrong, harmful. Why? Very simple. That and you're going to undertake something to get the thing. You know, if you like something, you're going to do something to get it. And if you dislike something, you're going to do something to get away from it. And we're assuming that it's something improper. It's a bad karma in a way. So for example, if you like money or something, that you would be driven to cheat someone to get it. Or if you dislike the person at the office, that you would be driven to do something to get away from this person. You know, you would be driven to try to get them fired or something like that. Or at least make them look bad, okay? I mean, we're Buddhists. We're not so bad like we're going to go try to get the guy fired. But if something we did made him look bad, then we wouldn't mind. I mean, that's, you know, that's lay sock. You just collected some karma, okay? I think it's between step 4 and 5 that the essence lies. If you wanted to get rid of this irritating guy at the office, what would be the best way? Yeah. Yeah, it'd be nice. Like, if you could change your perception. But can you voluntarily, willingly change your perception? You can't. And I don't mean a psychological... You have to distinguish between a psychological changing and a reality changing. And there's a big difference. Psychological changing means if you try really hard, you can try to control yourself and not feel bad about this guy. And most people are concentrating on that. In Buddhism, we tend to concentrate on that. You know, you feel bad that you don't like the guy. And you try to control your emotions. And you use all the tricks that Shantideva mentions, you know. And that's one way to deal with this irritating guy. But there's a more fundamental way, which is simply to change the whole reality. You know, where did he come from? Where did he come from? I mean, you have to think like that. A Buddhist has to think like that. Don't deal with a band-aid, the present situation, try to feel good about a guy who's trying to get you, you know. Deal with the fundamental thing of the reality. Where did this actual incident come from? Where did this person come from? Who created this person? Your own past deeds, you know. So if you want to avoid this person in the future, which is not a non-Buddhist thing, it's a very Buddhist thing, you're struggling to stop the truth of suffering. He is the truth of suffering, you know. You're struggling to remove this truth of suffering. It doesn't mean you're going to hurt him or kill him or something like that. How do you remove the person who's bad to you? Yeah. The main thing is to avoid repeating the mistake you did in the past, because the natural reaction to this guy is what? The natural reaction is try to hurt him back. And that's precisely the karmic deed that would cause what? The same guy will come back. You know, if you don't want to meet the guy again, just be good to him. You know, you know, if you don't want to see this object again, if you're tired of samsara, that's the only, that's the perfection of wisdom. You know, that's the perfection of wisdom. At that moment, you respond with kindness, not because it's, you know, in some idealistic way the right thing to do. It's self-preservation. It's self-interest. The Dalai Lama calls it enlightened self-interest, you know. Stop reacting bad. Be good to the person, you know. Be kind back to him. By the way, it doesn't mean that a Buddhist has to be wimpy. You know, if somebody's out there harming someone else, we had the children when they came yesterday, it was the second kind of giving was what? Do you remember? Yeah, Minjikpa Jimba. To give protection to someone. I mean, if you see someone harming someone else, even in your office, you are obligated by your bodhisattva vows to try to help that person. You're obligated to try to contain that person, non-violently if you can. You know, you're obligated to try to stop the injury going on. You're required to do that. So it doesn't mean being wimpy, but you're never allowed to hate the person. That would be a bad karma that would make you see the person again. Trying to stop them is a different thing if they're truly harmful. But hating them and disliking them is a different thing. That's a sembha, that's a karma, and it's going to give you a bad result. So out of love and out of compassion, you might have to stop somebody. But that's distinguished from hating them. That's a different thing. That's a bad karma. So the worst thing you can do when this person is hurting you, if all this stuff about karma and emptiness is true, is to react badly to them. And when you stop acting badly, you start collecting good karma, and you're not collecting bad karma anymore. So that's the trick between step number 4 and step number 5. If you don't know what you're doing, in order to get the things that you want and avoid the things that you don't want, you will undertake karma, and that's a big mistake. If you want to get rich, what's the best way? I like to, you know, I'm in business. I spend half my year in a big corporation, and the boss hands out Forbes magazine every couple months, and we're required to read these things. And in the first part of the magazine is this long explanation why so-and-so took a big risk and failed, and the company went under, and what a fool he was, like that guy in Hong Kong, that trader in Hong Kong. I mean, he put under a huge bank by some stupid risk-taking. And then if you flip to the back, there'll be an article about this other guy who took a lot of risks and it came out right, and he's a genius, you know. and it's the same riff, you know, it's the same thing. So I mean, is taking risk or not taking risk correct? Which one is the way to make money? I ask you, which is the proper financial strategy? Taking risk or not taking risk? Which is proper? So is it true that everyone who takes risks becomes rich? So that's not the proper strategy. So let's go to the other one. Is not taking risks the proper strategy? It's not, because people fail all the time who don't take risks, and they should have taken a risk, you know. What it means is it's almost a child's question. It's almost a fool's question. The fact is that even under the same circumstances, neither taking risks nor not taking risks is the right financial strategy. They don't create wealth. It's not the cause for wealth. That's not where the money's coming from. You see stupid people get rich and smart people go broke. You know, you see risk takers get rich and non-risk takers get rich too. It's not what's causing wealth. It's not what causes money. That's not what happens. So what's causing wealth? I mean, it's very simple. Neither one is doing it. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to see. That's not what's causing it. Something else is causing it. What? Specifically what? Giving. Yeah.
Giving.
Generosity. It's very interesting. You can take investment strategy A or take investment strategy B, but if you don't have the karma of having given things to someone, neither one will work. And if you do have the karma of having given things to other people, they'll both work. You know, you can have a low-risk account and a high-risk account, and they'll both work. And that's the truth, and you can see it. You don't have to be a genius. It's so simple that you miss it. It's like you don't see the forest for the trees. It's obvious. It's obvious. No one in 200 years of American history has figured out whether risk-taking is right or not taking risking is right, because the answer is neither. It's giving. Giving is what creates wealth. Yeah, you had a question.
Are you going to let Forbes magazine know?
You know, one time Inc. magazine contacted me one time and said they wanted to know how Buddhism relates to business, and I wrote this thing, but they didn't publish it. So that's Lay Sot.
Is grandpa always
accumulating
bad karma?
No. Ignorant good karma also. That's sort of like where you're good but you don't know why, because it's just a habit from your past life. And if you don't learn why it's right to be good, most people lose it by the time they die. You know, there's a lot of people who come into this life naturally pretty patient or kind or intelligent, you know, spiritually nice. But if you don't know why, if it's just a habit from your past life, it's very dangerous. Because normally you lose it. Normally it gets corrupted. At some point in your life, you meet some bad friends and you know, you used to be a nice guy, and then you get influenced by them. It's easy to go downhill and hard to go up. Say korwa.
Korwa.
Kor.
Korwar.
Kor.
Korwar.
Kor. That's step number 6. Because you've collected karma, then step number 6 happens. What is that? Korwa means what? Wheel means korwa means like sipe korwa is the wheel of life. And korwa kor means to spin in the wheel, to wheel around the wheel. So the minute you start collecting karma, then that life, that wheel of life starts to spin. And it starts to feed itself. It starts to perpetuate itself. Why? Let's take the case of the guy at work, irritating guy at work. If you respond to your misperception of this irritating guy by trying to hurt him, then what? It's perpetuating. That's what korwa kor means. It's perpetuating the same thing again. I think you could even translate it as perpetuating it. You know, you're just doing exactly the wrong thing. If you had to pick out of 1,000 options the worst thing to do that's going to make you go through this thing again, it would be responding to the guy in kind. You know, by the way, your bodhisattva vows, they require that you don't. I mean, if you're keeping if you have bodhisattva vows, one of them is that you're not allowed to respond in kind to injury. You know, if someone yells at you, you're not allowed to yell back, or you break your vow. If someone beats you, you're not allowed to beat them back. There's 4 different options in that vow. And you're not allowed to do this. And there's a good reason why, because that would just perpetuate the cycle. So this is my trans example. Let's go through all, was it six? The first one was what? The first step. We'll go lung jung, and then we'll go lung do, okay? Lung jung is, you have the seeds from your past life. The tendency, the seeds for the tendency to think things exist from their own side. And then the tendency itself asserts itself at a very early age. I mean, even as an infant, you can see kids being ignorant. the tendency asserts itself. Then that tendency causes you to mistake. You have mistaken perceptions. You think that nice things come from their own side, and you think that bad things come from their own side. That the guy at work, that bad quality is part of him, and no participation on your part required. If you walked out of the office, he'd still be a bad guy. Okay, that's the misperception of good thing, of nice things and bad things. And then number four, that causes what? That triggers something else. Oh yeah, detaching shina. Yeah, liking and not liking, because you don't understand that object, because you think the irritating quality of him is coming from him and not from you. You dislike him. You dislike him, or you like something else. And that causes you, because you dislike some things and like other things, you collect karma by reacting. By reacting stupidly, ignorantly. Okay? You react stupidly. And because you have responded with exactly the kind of action that will create this guy again, it perpetuates the cycle. Okay? And that's samsara in a nutshell. Okay? If you want, that's samsara in a nutshell. It's pretty cool. It's by Maitreya. If you want to know how you got in trouble, that's how it happened. If you want to know how to stay there, just keep doing it. You know? Okay? I'd like to take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about what to do about it, and then we'll talk about purification. One question, then we'll take a break. Yeah.
Collect karma from the feeling of liking or disliking, or the reaction to it. That confuses me.
Oh, yeah, it's a good question. You're asking, what you're really asking is Semba the karma, or are the deeds instigated by Semba the karma? And what's the answer? They're both. Yeah. The original emotion is a bad karma. It's a twitching of the mind.
But isn't that karma itself?
It is.
So where is the opportunity to change?
You have to change the ignorance part. That's why everything... Oh, and I missed... it's a good point. You brought up one more point. There's two ways to draw those three animals in the middle of the wheel of life. Do you know the two ways? Have you seen them?
Coming out of the mouth of the pig, and then the other...
Yeah. There's one way of drawing it where they're all... One's mouth is at the other's tail, and all three of them are like that. Those are in the recent paintings. In the ancient paintings, it's out of the pig's mouth is coming the rooster and the pig is ignorance. The pig is misperceiving pleasant objects and unpleasant objects. And that triggers the other two. They are the source. It is the source of the other two. And that's actually the correct way to draw it. That was the ancient way of drawing it. You'll see in very old tankas, you'll see that it's drawn that way. Okay, have a break, huh? Some tea.
This is the end of session 2. Session 3.
What's a self-existent irritating guy at the office? I mean, what would he look like?
Oh, I got a picture.
I have a picture.
No, I mean, it would be an irritating guy at the office who was irritating from his own side, and it's that simple. That's all. That's the object of negation. and you grasp to it all day long. You know, you grasp to it all day long. It's an irritating guy at the office who's irritating from his own side, and not because you're projecting, not because your karma has forced you to project an irritating guy on a simple collection of colors and shapes. You know, so does that mean he's somehow unreal? No. Does that mean he's not yelling at you? No. You know, does that mean that he's not an irritating guy? Not at all. He is irritating to you. Okay, because you're being forced to interpret those particular colors and shapes as an irritating fellow. And the self-existent object there, which never existed anyway, but if it did exist, it would be this guy who's out there, and being irritating is some quality of his own. And it's not dependent on your perceptions. You know, 'cause that doesn't exist. There is no such person. Is there an imagination of such a person? Yeah. Okay. Big difference. It's a gakcha and gakshe dushe. Gakcha means the self-existent object, which doesn't exist. But gakcha dushe is where I do have a mental image of this guy. That certainly exists. Okay. Big difference. So that's a self-existent guy. So what are you supposed to do then? And this is a very interesting question in Buddhism. Are you supposed to not like anything then? Are you supposed to not dislike anything? Are you supposed to try to put up with all the bad things in this life? And are you supposed to somehow not like the things you enjoy? And is that the right thing to do? I mean, sometimes as a Buddhist, you're caught in this feeling that, you know, you hear about great lamas who didn't like anything or didn't dislike anything at all. Is that what you're... I mean, is that correct? Is that you're supposed to not like anything and not dislike anything? Are you just supposed to say, I don't care what comes to me, I won't like anything and I won't dislike anything? Is that Buddhist practice? It's true you don't have a choice about the karma coming back to you, but... what I mean is, what do you imagine, how do the scriptures describe Dakpa Shinkam, Buddha Paradise? What is Buddha Paradise going to be like? They say the word suffering doesn't exist in those places because there's no object for it to refer to. You know, there are the words bliss, ecstasy, happiness, purity, you know, beauty. I mean, you're not trying to avoid those things. You're trying to actually find them, but find them in a permanent way. You know, that's all. It's not wrong, that human emotion or that human urge to go to some place which is happy, which is pure happiness, is why we're here. I mean, it would be stupid to... I mean, at the bottom of your heart, that's why you're in this class, hopefully. You want to reach this place of total purity and beauty and ecstasy. And you want to do that. And that's okay. It's just a question of the means. You know, the old means is dysfunctional. Getting mad at the guy is not the way to get away from him. It's being good to him. And running after the object you want is not the way to get it. Give it away if you want it. You know, if you want to get rich, be generous. You know, that's the way to get rich. It's very interesting. It's foolproof. How come people don't do it? It's very hard to perceive. Okay, it's very hard to perceive. It's the time lag that screws us up. You know, it's the time lag, and that's the big problem. It's that time lag. There's this natural time lag between doing the karma and getting the result. The bhakchaks have to have a time and space to mature, to ripen. And that time lag messes us up. As a normal human being, you're not capable of perceiving the connection between being generous and suddenly getting a raise at work 6 months later. You can't make that connection. A normal human being cannot do that. That's why the rules of karma and their consequences are deeper than what? Harder to perceive than emptiness itself. Okay, there's three levels of reality. One is called ngungyur. Ngungyur means evident reality, the reality that's sticking you in the face, obvious things. This is red, this is yellow, this is square. That's called ngungyur. Gokyur means deep. And that emptiness is in that category. If you perceive emptiness in this life once directly, it's fantastic. You know, it'd be incredibly wonderful. You'd be a stream enterer. You'd be on your way out. You're on this conveyor belt out of samsara. That's what stream enterer means. You stepped on that conveyor belt. And no matter what you do now, you're on your way out. Number three is Shindu Kokyur. And that's extremely subtle, deep. And that's the workings of karma. You know, if you do this, you'll get that. Chimgi Longju, Jinbei Longju Chimgi Dei, very famous from a sutra. Jinbei Longju means if you give, you will get. If you give away things, you'll get rich. Chimgi Dei means if you keep your morality, you'll be happy. Karmically, over a long period of time. But the only being who can see that is, guess who? Buddha. Okay, Ngungir things you can check out on your own. Whether this pillar is purple or not, whether that kapen is yellow or not, you can check that out on your own. You don't need any great logic or teachings to catch that. Kokyur, you need normally logic or some kind of reasoning. You have to think it out. You're not going to perceive emptiness unless somebody sits there and explains it to you and you contemplate it and then you perceive it. So as human beings, normal human beings, we can see obvious reality with our eyes. Kokyur things, subtle things, we can only see by thinking carefully. And then we see them with our mind. Shindu Kokyur, how do you guess? I mean, what other means are available to a normal person? Aside from your senses and your thoughts. That comes under thought. That comes under logic. But what about something even deeper? How are you going to perceive it? Scripture. Okay. And that's a little tough for Americans especially. What it means is, the only way you can see the connections between what you do and what you're going to get is by studying what the Buddha said. You cannot. It's very, very difficult to even figure it out logically. You know. Therefore, the Buddha taught 16 volumes of Vinaya, ethical living. Vinaya is not just monk's vows. It's 8 different sets of vows. 3 of them are for lay people. So you can study the parts that are for lay people. And in those whole 16,000 pages, the Buddha is explaining, if you do this, you'll get that. It's not obvious to you. You can't figure it out on your own. But I'm telling you, because I'm omniscient. You know, I can see that if you are generous, you're going to get rich. And I can see that if you keep your morality, you're going to be naturally a happy person later. But the connections are so deep that a normal human being can't see them. And you have to study them. You have to study them. That's the only way you can know what to do. Or keep your vows. You know, take vows, learn vows, take them, keep them. And then you're automatically doing the right things to get the right karmic results. Okay.
Session 3 continues on the next CD.